Whitbread and Potter were working in the acceleration chamber, moving the bunks to leave room for three smaller bunks. It was a simple re-welding job, but it took muscle. Perspiration collected in beads inside their filter helmets and soaked their armpits. Potter said,
"I wonder what a man smells like to a moti."
"Dinna answer if you find the question offensive," he added.
"'Tis a bit hard to say," Potter's moti answered. "My duty it is, Mr. Potter, to understand everything about my fjunch. Perhaps I fit the part too well. The smell of clean sweat wouldna offend me, even if you had nae been working in our own interest. What is it you find funny, Mr. Whitbread?"
"Sorry, it's the accent."
"What accent is that?"
Potter wondered. Whitbread and Whitbread's moti burst out laughing.
"Well, it is funny," said Whitbread's moti. "You used to have trouble telling us apart."
"Now it's the other way around," Jonathan Whitbread said. "I have to keep counting hands to know if I'm talking to Renner or Renner's moti. Give me a hand here, will you, Gavin?" "And Captain Blaine's moti. I have to keep shaking myself out of the attention position, and then she'll say something and I'll snap right back into it. She'll give orders like she's master of the cutter, and we'll obey, and then she'll say, 'Just a minute, mister,' and order us to forgive her. It's confusing."
"Even so," said Whitbread's moti, "I wonder sometimes whether we've really got you figured out. Just because I can imitate you doesn't mean I can understand you." "'Tis our standard technique, as old as the hills, as old as some mountain ranges. It works."
"What else can we do, Jonathan Whitbread's fjunch?"
"I wondered, that's all. These people are so versatile. We can't match all of your abilities, Whitbread. You find it easy to command and easy to obey. How can you do both? You're good with tools."
"So are you," said Whitbread, knowing it was an understatement.
"But we tire easily. You're ready to go on working, aren't you? We're not."
"Hmm.
And we aren't good at fighting." "Well, enough of that. We play your part in order to understand you, but you each seem to play 1,000 parts. It makes things difficult for an honest, hard-working, bug-eyed monster."
"Who told you about bug-eyed monsters?" Whitbread exclaimed.
"Mr. Renner, who else? I took it as a compliment, that he would trust my sense of humor, that is."
"Dr. Horvath would kill him. We're supposed to be tippy-toe careful in our relationship with aliens. Don't offend taboos and all that."
"Dr. Horvath," Potter said. "I am reminded that Dr. Horvath wanted us to ask you something. You know that we have a Brown aboard MacArthur?"
"Sure, a miner. Her ship visited MacArthur, then came home empty. It was pretty obvious she'd stayed with you."
"She's sick," Potter said. "She has been growing worse. Dr. Blevins says it has the marks of a dietary disease. But he has nay been able to help her. Have you any idea what it is that she might lack?"
Whitbread thought he knew why Horvath had not asked his moti about the Brown. If the motis demanded to see the miner, they must be refused on orders from the Admiral himself. Dr. Horvath thought the order was stupid. He would never be able to defend it. Whitbread and Potter were not called upon to try. Orders were orders. When the motis did not answer at once, Jonathan said, "Between them, the biologists have tried a lot of things. New foods, analysis of the Brown's digestive fluids, X-rays for tumor. They even changed the atmosphere in her cabin to match the Moat Prime atmosphere. Nothing works. She's unhappy. She whines. She doesn't move around much. She's getting thin. Her hair is coming out." Whitbread's moti spoke in a voice gone oddly flat. "You haven't any idea what might be wrong with her?"
"No," said Whitbread.
It was strange and uncomfortable the way the motis were looking at them. They seemed identical now, floating half-crouched, anchored by handholds, identical pose, identical markings, identical faint smiles. Their individual identities didn't show now. Perhaps it was all a pose.
"We'll get you some food," Potter's moti said suddenly. "You may hae guessed right. It may be her diet."
Both motis left. Presently, Whitbread's moti returned with a pressure bag that contained grain and plum-sized fruits and a chunk of red meat.
"Boil the meat, soak the grain, and give her the fruit raw,"
she said, and test the ionization in her cabin air. She ushered them out. The boys boarded an open scooter to return to the cutter. Presently Potter said, "They behaved very strangely. I cannot but think that something important happened a minute ago."
"Yeah."
"Then what was it?"
"Maybe they think we've been mistreating the Brown. Maybe they wonder why we won't bring her here. Maybe the other way around. They're shocked that we take so much trouble for a mere Brown.
And perhaps they were tired, and we imagined it." Potter fired thruster clusters to slow the scooter.
"Gavin, look behind us."
"Not now. I must see to the safety of my command."
Potter took his time docking the scooter, then looked around. More than a dozen Motis had been working outside the ship. The bracing for the toroids was conspicuously unfinished, but the Motis were all streaming into the airlock.
The mediators came streaming into the toroid, bouncing gently from the walls in their haste to get out of each other's way. Most of them showed in one way or another that they were fjunch, to aliens. They tended to underuse their lower right arms. They wanted to line themselves with their heads pointing all in the same direction. The master was white. The tufts at her armpits and groin were long and silky, like the fur of an Angora cat. When they were all there, the master turned to Whitbread's Moti and said, "Speak." Whitbread's Moti told of the incident with the midshipman. "I'm certain they meant it all," she concluded. To Potter's Moti, the master said, "Do you agree?"
"Yes, completely."
There was a panicky undercurrent of whispers, some in Moti tongues, some in Anglic. It cut off when the master said, "What did you tell them?"
"We told them the disease might well be a dietary deficiency."
There was shocked, human-sounding laughter among the mediators, none at all among the few who had not yet been assigned fjunch, and gave them food for the engineer. It will not help, of course.
"Were they fooled?"
"Difficult to tell. We are not good at lying directly. It is not our specialty," said Potter's Moti. A buzz of talk rose in the toroid. The master allowed it for a time. Presently she spoke. "What can it mean? Speak of this." One answered, "They cannot be so different from us. They fight wars. We have heard hints of whole planets rendered uninhabitable." Another interrupted. "There was something graceful, human feminine, in the way she moved. It seemed grotesque to the master. We think we know what causes humans to fight. Most animals on our world and theirs have a surrender reflex that prevents one member of a species from killing another. Humans use weapons instinctively. It makes the surrender reflex too slow." "But it was the same with us once," said a third. "Evolution of the mediator mules put an end to that. Do you say that humans do not have mediators?"
Sally Fowler's Moti said, "They have nothing that is bred for the task of communicating and negotiating between potential enemies. They are amateurs at everything, second best at everything they do. Amateurs do their negotiating. When negotiations break down, they fight."
"They are amateurs at playing master, too," one said. Nervously, she stroked the center of her face. "They take turns at playing master. In their warships, they station marines between fore and aft, in case the aft sections should wish to become masters of the ship. Yet when Lenin speaks, Captain Blaine obeys like a Brown. It is," she said, "difficult to be fjunch to a part-time master."
"Agreed," said Whitbread's Moti.
"Mine is not a master, but will be some day." Another said, "Our engineer has found much that needs improvement in their tools. There is now no class to fit Dr. Hardy."
"Stop this," said the master, and the noise stopped. "Our concern is more specific. What have you learned of their mating habits?"
"They do not speak of this to us. Learning will be difficult. There seems to be only one female aboard."
"One female?"
"To the best that we can learn."
"Are the rest neuters, or are most neuters?"
"It would seem that they are not. Yet the female is not pregnant, has not been pregnant at any time since our arrival."
"We must learn," said the master. "But you must also conceal. A casual question.
It must be asked very carefully, to reveal as little as possible. If what we suspect is true, can it be true?
One said, all of evolution is against it. Individuals that survive to breed must carry the genes for the next generation.
How then?
They are alien. Remember, they are alien, said Whitbread's Moti.
We must find out.
Select one among you and formulate your question, and select the human you will ask. The rest of you must avoid the subject unless the aliens introduce it.
I think we must conceal nothing.
One stroked the center of her face, as if for reassurance.
They are alien. They may be the best hope we have ever had. With their help, we may break the ancient pattern of the cycles.
The master showed her surprise. You will conceal the crucial difference between man and ourselves. They will not learn of it.
I say we must not, cried the other. Listen to me. They have their own ways. They solve problems, always.
The others converged on her.
No, listen. You must listen.
Crazy Eddie, the master said wonderingly.
Confine her in comfort. We will need her knowledge. No other must be assigned to her fjunch, since the strain has driven her mad. Blaine let the cutter lead MacArthur to Mote Prime at 0.780G. He was acutely aware that MacArthur was an alien warship capable of devastating half the Moti planet, and did not like to think of what weaponry might be trained on her by uneasy Motis. He wanted the embassy ship to arrive first. Not that it would really help, but it might. The cutter was almost empty now. The scientific personnel were living and working aboard MacArthur, reading endless data into the computer banks, cross-checking and codifying, and reporting their findings to the captain for transmission to Lenin. They could have reported directly, of course, but there are many privileges to rank. MacArthur's dinner parties and bridge games tended to become discussion groups. Everyone was concerned about the brown miner. She became steadily worse, eating as little of the food provided by the Motis as she had of MacArthur's provisions. It was frustrating, and Dr. Blevins tried endless tests with no results. The miniatures had waxed fat and fecund while loose aboard MacArthur, and Blevins wondered if they had been eating something unexpected, like missile propellant, or the insulation from cables. He offered her a variety of unlikely substances, but the Brown's eyesight grew dim, her fur came out in patches, and she howled. One day she stopped eating. The next, she was dead. Horvath was beside himself with fury. Blaine thought it fitting to call the embassy ship. The gently smiling brown and white that answered could only be Horvath's Moti, although Blaine would have been hard-pressed to say how he knew.
"Is my fjunch available?"
Rod asked. Horvath's Moti made him uncomfortable.
"I'm afraid not, Captain."
"All right. I called to report that the brown we had aboard this ship is dead. I don't know how much it means to you, but we did our best. The entire scientific staff of MacArthur tried to cure her."
"I'm sure of that, Captain. It doesn't matter. May we have the body?"
Rod considered it a moment. "I'm afraid not." He couldn't guess what the Motis could learn from the corpse of an alien that had never communicated when alive, but perhaps he was learning from Kutyasov. Could there have been micro-tattooing below the fur? And why weren't the Motis more concerned about the brown? That was something he certainly couldn't ask. Best to be thankful they weren't upset. "Give my regards to my fjunch."
"I have bad news also," said Horvath's Moti. "Captain, you no longer have a fjunch. She has gone mad."
"What?" Rod was more shocked than he would have believed.
"Mad? Why? How?"
"Captain, I don't imagine you can grasp what a strain it has been for her. There are Motis who give orders, and there are Motis who make and fix tools. We are neither. We communicate. We can identify with a giver of orders, and it is no strain. But an alien giver of orders? It was too much. She, how shall I put it? Mutiny. Your word is mutiny. We have none. She is safe and under confinement, but it is best for her that she does not speak with aliens again.
Thank you, Rod said. He watched the gently smiling image fade from the screen and did nothing more for 5 minutes. Finally, he sighed and began dictating reports for Lennon. He worked alone, and it was as if he had lost a part of himself and was waiting for it to come back. Part 3. Meet Crazy Eddie. 26. Moat Prime. Moat Prime. Marginally habitable world in the Trans-Coal Sack sector. Primary, G2 yellow dwarf star, approximately 10 parsecs, from the Trans-Coal Sack sector capital, New Caledonia. Generally referred to as the Moat in Murchison's Eye, QV, or the Moat, mass, 0.91 sol, luminosity, 0.78 sol. Moat Prime has a poisonous atmosphere, breathable with the aid of commercial or standard Navy-issue filters. Contraindicated for heart patients or where emphysema problems exist. Oxygen, 16%. Nitrogen, 79.4%. CO2, 2.9%. Helium, 1%. Complex hydrocarbons, including ketones, 0.7%. Gravity, 0.780 standard. The planetary radius is 0.84 and mass is 0.57 Earth standard. A planet of normal density. Period, 0.937 standard years, or 8,750.005 hours. The planet is inclined at 18 degrees, with semi-major axis of 0.93 AU. 137 million kilometers. Temperatures are cool. Poles uninhabitable and covered with ice. Equatorial and tropical regions are temperate to hot. The local day is 27.33 hours. There is one moon, small and close. It is asteroidal in origin, and the backside bears the characteristic indented crater typical of planetoids in the Moat system. The moon-based fusion generator and power beaming station are critical sources for the Moat Prime civilization. Topography, 50% ocean, not including extensive ice caps. Terrain is flat over most of the land area. Mountain ranges are low and heavily eroded. There are few forests. Arable lands are extensively cultivated. The most obvious features are circular formations, which are visible everywhere. The smallest are eroded to the limits of detection, while the largest can be seen only from orbit. Although the physical features of Moat Prime are of some interest, particularly to ecologists concerned with the effects of intelligent life, on planetography, the primary interest in the moat centers on its inhabitants. Two scooters converged at the cutter and suited figures climbed aboard. When both humans and Moaties had checked over the ship, the Navy ratings who had brought her to orbit gratefully turned her over to the midshipmen and returned to MacArthur. The middies eagerly took their places in the control cabin and examined the landscape below. "We're to tell you that all contact with you will be through this ship," Whitbread told his Moaty. "Sorry, but we can't invite you aboard, MacArthur." Whitbread's Moaty gave a very human shrug to express her opinion of orders. Obedience posed no strain on either her or her human. "What will you do with the cutter when you leave?" "It's a gift," Whitbread told her. "Maybe you'll want it for a museum. There are things the captain wants you to know about us." "And things he wants to conceal, certainly." From orbit, the planet was all circles, seas, lakes, an arc of a mountain range, the line of a river, a bay. There was one eroded and masked by a forest. It would have been undetectable had it not fallen exactly across a line of mountains, breaking the backbone of a continent as a man's foot breaks a snake. Beyond, a sea the size of the Black Sea showed a flattish island in the exact center. "The magma must have welled up where the asteroid tore the crust open," said Whitbread. "Can you imagine the sound it must have made?" Whitbread's Moaty nodded. "No wonder you moved all the asteroids out to the Trojan points. That was the reason, wasn't it?" "I don't know. Our records are uncomplete from that long ago.
I imagine the asteroids must have been easier to mine, easier to make a civilization from, once they were lumped together like that. Whitbread remembered that the beehive had been stone cold, without a trace of radiation. Just how long ago did all this happen?
Oh, at least 10,000 years.
Whitbread, how old are your oldest records?
I don't know. I could ask someone.
The midshipman looked down. They were crossing the Terminator, which was a series of arcs. The night side blazed with a galaxy of cities. Earth might have looked this way during the Co-Dominium, but the Empire's worlds had never been so heavily populated.
Look ahead. Whitbread's Moti pointed to a fleck of flame at the world's rim. That's the transfer ship. Now we can show you our world.
I think your civilization must be a lot older than ours, said Whitbread.
Sally's equipment and personal effects were packed and ready in the cutter's lounge, and her minuscule cabin seemed bare and empty now. She stood at the viewport and watched the silver arrowhead approach MacArthur. Her Moti was not watching.
I have a rather indelicate question, Sally's fianch said.
Sally turned from the viewport. Outside, the Moti ship had come alongside, and a small boat was approaching from MacArthur.
Go ahead. What do you do if you don't want children yet?
Oh, dear, said Sally, and she laughed a little. She was the only woman among nearly 1,000 men, and in a male-oriented society. She had known all this before she came, but still she missed what she thought of as girl talk. Marriage and babies and housekeeping and scandals. They were part of civilized life. She hadn't known how big a part until the New Chicago Revolt caught her up, and she missed it even more now. Sometimes, in desperation, she had talked recipes with MacArthur's cooks as a poor substitute. But the only other feminine-oriented mind within light years was her fianch.
Fianch, the alien reminded her. I wouldn't raise the subject, but I think I ought to know. Do you have children aboard MacArthur?
Me? No, Sally laughed again. I'm not even married.
Married?
Sally told the Moti about marriage. She tried not to skip any basic assumptions. It was sometimes hard to remember that the Moti was an alien.
This must sound a bit weird, she finished. Come, I will conceal nothing from you, as Mr. Renner would say.
The mimicry was perfect, including gestures.
I think your customs are strange. I doubt that we'll adopt many of them, given the differences in physiology.
Well, yes.
But you marry to raise children. Who raises children born without marriage?
There are charities, Sally said grimly. Her distaste was impossible to disguise.
I take it you've never?
The Moti paused delicately.
No, of course not. How not? I don't mean why not, I mean how.
Well, you know that men and women have to have sexual relations to make a baby, the same as you. I've examined you pretty thoroughly.
So that if you aren't married, you just don't
get together?
That's right.
Of course, there are pills a woman can take if she likes men but doesn't want to take the consequences.
Pills? How do they work? Hormones?
The Moti seemed interested, if somewhat detached.
That's right.
They had discussed hormones. Moti physiology employed chemical triggers also, but the chemicals were quite different.
But a proper woman doesn't use them, Sally's Moti suggested.
No.
When will you get married?
When I find the right man. She thought for a moment, hesitated, and added, I may have found him already. And the damn fool may already be married to his ship, she added to herself.
Then why don't you marry him?
Sally laughed. I don't want to jump into anything. Marry in haste, repent at leisure. I can get married any time. Her trained objectivity made her add, Well, any time within the next 5 years. I'll be something of a spinster if I'm not married by then.
Spinster?
People would think it odd. Curious now, she asked.
What if a Moti doesn't want children?
We don't have sexual relations, Sally's Moti said primly. There was an almost inaudible clunk as the ground-to-orbit ship secured alongside.
The landing boat was a blunt arrowhead coated with ablative material. The pilot's cabin was a large wraparound transparency, and there were no other windows. When Sally and her Moti arrived at the entryway, she was startled to see Horace Berry just ahead of her.
"You're going down to the moat, Your Excellency?" Sally asked.
"Yes, my lady." Berry seemed as surprised as Sally. He entered the connecting tube to find that the Motis had employed an old Navy trick. The tube was pressurized, with a lower pressure at the receiving end, so that the passengers were wafted along. The interior was surprisingly large, with room for all. Renner, Sally Fowler, Chaplain Hardy. Berry wondered if they would ship him back up to MacArthur every Sunday. Dr. Horvath, Midshipman Whitbread, and Staley. Two ratings Berry did not recognize, and alien counterparts for all but three of the humans. He noted the seating arrangements with an amusement that only partly covered his fears. Four abreast, with a Moti seat beside each of the human seats. As they strapped in, he was further amused. They were one short. But Dr. Horvath moved forward into the control cabin and took a seat next to the brown pilot. Berry settled into the front row, where seats were only two abreast, and a Moti took the other. Fear surged into his throat. "Allah is merciful. I witness that Allah is one." No! There was nothing to fear, and he had done nothing dangerous. And yet he was here, and the alien was beside him, while behind him on MacArthur any accident might bring the ship's officers to discover what he had done to his pressure suit. A pressure suit is the most identity-locked artifact a man of space can own. It is far more personal than a pipe or a toothbrush. Yet others had exposed their suits to the ministrations of the unseen brownies. During the long voyage to Moat Prime, Commander Sinclair had examined the modifications the brownies had made. Berry had waited. Presently, he learned through Nabil that the brownies had doubled the efficiency of the recycling systems. Sinclair had returned the pressure suits to their owners and begun modifying the officers' suits in a similar fashion. One of the air tanks on Berry's suit was now a dummy. It held half a liter of pressurized air and two miniatures in suspended animation. The risks were great. He might be caught. The miniatures might die from the frozen sleep drugs. Someday he might need air that was not there. Berry had always been willing to take risks for sufficient profit. When the call came, he had been certain he was discovered. A Navy rating had appeared on his room screen, said, "Call for you, Mr. Berry," smiled evilly, and switched over. Before he could wonder, Berry found himself facing an alien. "Fjunsch," said the alien. It cocked its head and shoulders at him. "You seem confused. Surely you know the term." Berry had recovered quickly. "Of course, I was not aware that any Moti was studying me." He did not like the idea at all. "No, Mr. Berry. I have only just been assigned. Mr. Berry, have you thought of coming to Moat Prime?" "No, I doubt that I would be allowed to leave the ship." "Captain Blaine has given permission. If you are willing, Mr. Berry, we would deeply appreciate your comments regarding the possibilities for trade between the Moat and the Empire. It seems likely we would both profit." "Yes, beard of the prophet, an opportunity like that." Berry had agreed quickly. Nabil could guard the hidden brownies. But now, as he sat aboard the landing boat, it was difficult to control his fears. He looked at the alien beside him. "I am Dr. Horvath's Fjunsch," the Moti said. "You should relax. These boats are well designed."
"Ah," said Berry.
And he relaxed. The worst was hours away. Nabil had by now safely removed the dummy tank into MacArthur's main airlock with hundreds of others, and it would be safe. The alien ship was undoubtedly superior to similar human craft, if for no other reason than the Moti's desire to avoid risk to the human ambassadors. But it was not the trip down that kept fear creeping into his throat until it tasted bright and sharp like new copper. There was a slight lurch. The descent had begun. To everyone's surprise, it was dull,
There were occasional shifts in gravity, but no turbulence. Three separate times they felt almost subliminal clunks, as of landing gear coming down, and then there was a rolling sensation. The ship had come to rest. They filed out into a pressurized chamber. The air was good but scentless, and there was nothing to see but the big inflated structure around them. They looked back at the ship and stared unashamedly.